This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston, a Beasley Broadcast Group station.
Thanks for tuning in to Tube Talk, gang. Here we go. Thanks for tuning in, gang. It's 1940, and that's Artie Shaw. And this is Tube Talk, and we're coming off a big old-fashioned radio high here. Back this weekend from Radio 45 out in Westford, Mass. And despite a snowstorm, we had big crowds. All the dealers were there. Big gangs of folks checking out the merchandise. A lot of collectors swapping war stories. So, you know, a real break to the cabin fever that one can get up here in New England. And certainly this winter we deserved a great radio show. Lots of nice stuff changed hands. And I was noticing a lot of the merchandise, a lot of older wooden sets, which is very nice. Sometimes you get the idea that that wooden stuff is not going to come back for public purchase, but it certainly seemed to be all around us out in Westford, Mass. So if you hadn't been there, well, you know, check out the NEARC.net website. I'm sure we'll be posting some photos and a recap. It was a blast. And, you know, on the train here on my way over tonight, another snowy, sloppy, cold New England evening. And certainly we don't have a monopoly on that up here this year. That's enough to go around the whole country. And, you know, as I'm looking at the train barreling through the cloud of snow, looking at that single headlight starting to turn from a little ember into a glowing orb as we pull up to the stop. You know, it was so poetic. If I was a songwriter, I should have wrote a song, but I'm not, and I didn't. So we'll go with this.
Mm-hmm. stars from the skies. There they are in your eyes. For the angels came through. Sunbeams to wear in your hair. Sure enough, they are there. For the angels came through. When you wanted a love song, angels composed. Then they enclosed it. Deep in this red rose I give you, then you wanted someone whose love wouldn't die. Funny thing, so did I. And the angels came through.
That's The Angels Came Through, Glenn Miller and his orchestra, Wilbur Schwartz. Remember old Wilbur from down the schoolyard? Wilbur Schwartz on the clarinet, Tex Beneke on the tenor saxophone, and Ray Eberle, boy, ever so sweet, on the vocal. That's from 1941. Well, gang, thanks for being our guest tonight. You are a guest of sorts, sitting there, hopefully, in a nice room, beautifully lit dial. Warm sound of a vacuum tube set playing. Good music and interesting talk. So thanks for being part of our show, because you certainly are a guest in our comfy, cozy radio parlor where we play the music and try to recapture that feel of the classic days of radio. So drop us a line if you like what you hear. It's tubetalk1@gmail.com. Check out tubetalkclassicradioshow.org. for a little bit more information about why we are here.
Never argue with your heart. It isn't smart. It isn't sound. Love don't know from season, logic, rhyme, or reason. Love can be found in every port. Love gets around. In short, it has happened to a cricket in a thicket. It has happened on a streetcar and a bus. There has even been a rumor it has happened to a puma. Why shouldn't it happen to us? It has happened to the mama of a llama, to a pelican, and to an octopus. Since it happened to the swordfish, it no longer is a bored fish. Why shouldn't it happen to us? It's elusive, profusive. Nobody has an exclusive on love, man, beast, or a dove. Take the regal old eagle, the porcupine and the beagle, yes, and kangaroo, all pitch woo. It has happened to a tuna at Laguna, to a girl named Myrtle and a guy named Gus. Hiawatha said, come to me by the shores of Gitchagumi. Why shouldn't it happen to us? Oh, Oh, the busy little hornet doesn't scorn it. To ignore it really is ridiculous. It's a ritual in Turkey, Martinique and Albuquerque. Why shouldn't it happen to us? There's no ration on passion. L'amour is always in fashion. It wings beggars and kings. Take the cheetah and eater, the halibut and the mosquito. Yes, and billy goats feel their oats. Oh, it thrills the tiny sparrow to its marrow. And the armadillo deems it super plus. Why, our ancient barnyard rooster finds it quite a morale booster. Why shouldn't it happen to us? I have even heard a reindeer whisper, please say that again, dear. Why, oh, why shouldn't it happen to us?
That'll warm you up on a nice wintry night, Mr. Frank Sinatra. Cute little song, Why Shouldn't It Happen to Us? And you know, there's so much out there in the Sinatra songbook. Certainly not saying I don't like the super hits, because we like the super hits, but there's a lot of stuff just around the peripheries that really deserves to be played, and stuff he sounds so good on, especially with that nice, young, supple, flexible voice. Oh, what it's like to be young. Well, before we go on down to the old parlor tonight for some more radio chat, let's sneak in a little Johnny Mercer.
Met a gal in Calico down in Santa Fe. Used to be her Sunday beau till I rode away. Do I want her? Do I want her love? Yes, sirree. Will I win her? Will I win her love? Wait and see. Working with a rodeo, go from town to town. Most every kind of gal, every kind of gal. But who made my heart sing? Yippee-yay, yippee-yo, my little gal in Calico.
Let's head on down and see who's in the guest room tonight. Tube Talk is very pleased, ladies and gentlemen, to have Gary Frost join us back to continue the fascinating discussion on Edwin Armstrong. And we're going to get into FM tonight, which is something that most people equate with Armstrong. And Gary is the author of Early FM Radio, Incremental Technology in 20th Century America. He's also been a visiting professor at Rochester's Institute of Technology and at Auburn University, and also previously a guest on the radio show for the Vintage Collector Tube Talk. Gary, thanks for coming back so quick. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, you know, Armstrong and FM are really where we want to go tonight, and it's something that most people in my hobby strongly equate. You know, and it's interesting, too, there are some people who will get to the point that if a system does not use Armstrong's patents, they don't want it. You know, so that it's that visceral in the antique radio community. Some people look at ratio detection type devices as opposed to the Armstrong system, and they say, well, you know, I want that genuine Armstrong system. And I know a lot of companies used to use that to their advantage. I know Zenith went crazy and put stickers on the back of all of these sets. You know, we use the Armstrong system. So Armstrong and FM are very much hand in hand. And, you know, your opinion here from what I can read, and I'm going to, you know, quote something here from a review. This is from David Croder, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and he indicates, warning, reading this book is certain to change the way you think about FM radio history, about Edwin Armstrong, and about Armstrong's best-known biographer, Lawrence Lessig. So maybe you can kind of run with that a little bit and tell us, you know, Armstrong wasn't really the first, was he?
No, and I began researching the history of FM radio by reading Lessig. And it's a very appealing story that I ended up challenging on a number of fronts. One front was that it was Lessig's implied claim that Armstrong invented FM radio entirely by himself and developed it by himself. In fact, in the face of opposition by big business, particularly the Radio Corporation of America.
Yep.
What I found was that first FM radio patents were issued in as early as 1903, and that RCA, Westinghouse, General Electric, to a lesser extent, were very actively trying to find out during the 1920s what FM was good for. Armstrong was aware of these efforts. He had free access to RCA's research and development laboratories. And I guess, I'm not accusing Armstrong of stealing anything necessarily, but Armstrong was just one of many people who were developing FM radio, but starting in the 1920s. And he certainly made some important improvements in the technology and made it into essentially the broadcast technology that we have today. But he wasn't at all, it's not at all inevitable that we had to have someone like Armstrong. If there had been no Armstrong, RCA almost certainly would have developed a commercial version of FM radio.
I see. Very interesting. And, you know, the other thing I would like to get back to on this is, given Armstrong's history here, as we talked a little bit about last time, you know, success with regeneration, success with Super Heterodyne, you know, simply even just lending his name and getting involved with it probably did a lot in the community, the radio community, to say this is something that deserves some attention.
The one organization it didn't seem to make much impression on was RCA. Ironically, the organization he worked and you could say collaborated with most. But once Armstrong took, I argue that RCA, contrary to Lessig, didn't try to kill FM radio. It simply didn't understand it, and Armstrong took FM out to the public and recruited essentially a network of other developers of FM radio, networks outside the RCA organization started investing in FM radio. He started picking up a lot of users of FM broadcasting from college stations, for instance.
Interesting.
And it is true, the Armstrong's fundamental breakthrough was that he widened the frequency swing of FM radio. That is absolutely vital to having the kind of FM radio we have now, including the high fidelity that every other kind of FM radio, including the one that RCA was working on, lacked. So that's a good reason why you would want our FM radio technology to use the FM patents. Some of the receivers of FM radio, for instance, I mean, Cornelius Ehret invented the slope detector, which is used as late as the 1960s. Armstrong did make some big, big breakthroughs, primarily by radically widening the frequency swing of FM radio.
Now, you know, it's interesting because in the way, you know, the human mind thinks, it's interesting, you know, the David and Goliath mentality. And certainly, you know, I don't know how much of a David, you know, Armstrong was, because as we talked about earlier, he certainly had some wealth behind him, and he was a very determined guy, and, you know, he certainly wasn't, you know, was certainly willing to legally pursue his point of view, so to speak. You know, so I think there's this natural thing sometimes that people want to say somehow Sarnoff was, you know, he was out to get him, and that's why RCA, you know, wasn't as interested in FM as they could have been, and, you know, they run with that ball a little bit. And, to me, from what I know, I don't know how, you know, the personal relationship Sarnoff and Armstrong was, but it almost seems like, you know, every time I read about Sarnoff, absolutely obsessed with television. Television, television, television. And it may, do you think it's safe to say that maybe some of his lack of passion or interest in FM was simply due to the fact that he had his eye on that one ball, which was television?
I think that's absolutely true. Sarnoff and Armstrong had once been very good friends. Their friendship dated back to 1913 when he first demonstrated
yes,
the regeneration
with Moorcroft,
circuit.
Yep.
I spent a considerable amount of time going through Armstrong's archives, including all the documents involved in the patent litigation case he had with RCA. And what struck me was that during the litigation, now that litigation started in the late 1940s, the friendship had ended, but I was reading documents dating back to the 1920s, and the strong impression I got was David Sarnoff didn't think about FM radio very much, and he certainly didn't try to kill it, because for the very reason you say, Paul, he was obsessed with television, and the idea that Sarnoff, as Lessing implies, was trying to protect his RCA's empire in AM radio is ridiculous for several reasons. One of the most important reasons, he was hoping to destroy the AM radio empire with television.
Right.
So, and I just don't think I found absolutely no evidence at all that Sarnoff even took much part in deciding whether RCA would do anything with FM radio. I have to admit, when you're researching a particular subject, you always have to fight off the urge that everybody's thinking about what you're thinking about. But the reality was that RCA had a lot on its plate, and they were developing television. They were trying to develop overseas radio telephony technology, facsimile. They were working on a lot of things, and FM was just one of them. And because they misunderstood the technology of FM, it was too late. They let it slip out of their hands, not because they were hostile to FM, but because management simply didn't understand what it was FM was good for. And that's a surprising thing to a lot of people, but that's the fact. As I like to say, engineers would rather be perceived as being evil than incompetent, and RCA let FM go because their engineering managers didn't understand the technology well enough to realize the potential of FM radio. They completely got it wrong.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, because I think for those who, you know, maybe on the one hand overestimate Sarnoff in his, you know, this desire to you know, rub Armstrong out of the picture, you know, how do you underestimate on one hand, and, you know, a guy like Sarnoff in a company which was really, as you were pointing out, I mean, RCA was an empire even in the 50s, you know, it was the production of tubes, the production of equipment, you know, all the facilities, all the plants. They have this renowned engineering department. If by some reason they did miss FM, and all of a sudden, well, you know, here's FM, and a bunch of other guys brought it out. You know what? I have a firm belief that if Sarnoff were to light a fire under RCA and say, look, you guys, we missed the boat on this, and we're going to have some FM receivers, and they're going to be quality RCA FM receivers, they would have very soon showed up on the scene with a quality, I don't know if they would use the Armstrong patents, but I'm sure that as an organization, RCA could have come up and competed in that market.
Yeah, that's pretty much what happened, actually. They let Armstrong test his system beginning in 1934, and after about a year and a half, because they were testing it improperly, they had very low power transmitters, and they were testing it as a long range radio telephony.
I see.
Not like the local. I mean, FM works best when it's local.
Right.
And Armstrong was picking up these crystal clear broadcasts from the Empire State Building in 1934 in his laboratory a few blocks away at Columbia. Meanwhile, engineers are reporting that reception was sporadic in Philadelphia.
And sure.
It's not at all surprising with a 2-kilowatt transmitter. They just didn't know what they were doing.
Right. You know, it's interesting too, because if I'm not mistaken here, I believe Zenith was actually running an experimental FM station during the war in Chicago, but it was a low power thing, and they were essentially using it for entertainment. I believe it was FM.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was some experimentation out there. And to your point, if from an engineering point of view, if I can't pick up signals in Philadelphia on FM, well, meanwhile, I can listen to WLW in the middle of the country. Well, yeah. Why would I want to switch over to FM, you know, when I can pick up these 50,000-watt stations? You know, granted, they may not have been familiar with the advantages in certain aspects of FM, but it would almost seem to be easy to write it off in light of the, especially the in those days with minimal RF interference in the world, you know, in the country, you know, AM DXing was unbelievable.
Well, actually, the FCC set up a commercial service that began just before Pearl Harbor. After the Pearl Harbor attack, there was a freeze on radio, and there were no FM broadcasting station licenses issued, nor you couldn't even buy vacuum tubes because of the military
situation. Yep, all to war, yep.
And it looked pretty rosy for FM radio, and at the hearing where the FCC was supposed to have a debate about FM radio, even RCA, which had just recently kind of caught up a little bit, even RCA was urging the FCC to set up an FM a commercial FM service. I mean, one thing to remember is that RCA didn't really have a kind of capital investment that made FM radio scary. FM radio receivers use more tubes. Well, RCA was in the vacuum tube business. They stood to make more money.
Sure.
They only owned 11 radio stations, and they made far more money managing radio celebrities and essentially handling this, what we would now call the software, the technology, instead of the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked pretty good for FM radio. Now, there is a big question, which I will admit to anybody, I never was able to answer why FM radio was so slow to catch on after the war, particularly when it caught on in other countries much more rapidly. FM radio just kind of slogged along and didn't catch on until the 1980s. And I don't really have a technological or economic reason for that. Except that some people have often expressed a preference for the way radio sounded. They just kind of got used to the way AM radio sounded, kind of like an old pair of slippers or something. But,
yeah, you know, I would say it was until the movie FM came out with Donald Faye.
Yeah. Where I always thought FM radio was rescued by rock and roll.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, you may be on to, I mean, this is the type of intellectual activity that, you know, I can proffer. You know,
yeah,
and you know, you get stuff, and I think as a kid growing up, especially 70s, early 80s, the onset of component stereo. So you had speakers that became within somebody's price range to get, and certainly the AM-FM tuner starts to come onto the scene. You know, it can run your turntable. It can certainly run your cassette deck. So this, and there's a whole industry. There were chains of stores that were, you know, devised to promote component stereo. And the heart of any component system was an AM-FM tuner. And you know why that is. I think, especially with music, as things started to get more synthesized and the sounds became more than just instruments, that was something that people said, hey, you know, it sounds a lot better on FM. Not to say there weren't plenty of top 40 AM stations floating around still. But in a way, I think, you know, you're probably, you know, dead to rights with that, with that interpretation, because FM certainly becomes the preferred system for listening to music. And, you know, again, I go back, I've mentioned this before, but you know, we generally tend to be a little older in this hobby, and who doesn't remember the first kid on the block to get an FM converter to put on that Delco AM radio that you had in your dad's car? But it starts to really come of age. Now, we had talked a little bit before we came onto the air. Armstrong was involved with the Yankee Network, which was an attempt at, you know, doing some programming and getting a network of FM stations up and running. And maybe you can give us a little idea of what his involvement in that was.
Yeah, that Yankee Network is a fascinating part of the story. And I think the owner of the Yankee Network, John Shepherd III, and his chief engineer, Paul DeMars, I think are real heroes, almost to the point of having, you know, the same stature as Armstrong himself. Armstrong understood that he wasn't going to spread FM radio around all by himself just because he builds a station in New Jersey. He needed to get lots of people to adapt the technology. And one of the earliest, recruits to this kind of FM pioneer army that he started was Paul DeMars, who brought in his boss, John Shepherd. And the Yankee Network, of course, in the 1930s, it was the biggest network in New England, and John Shepherd was a very ambitious man, and he had a problem that he was never going to get a clear channel station, because AM radio stations, once they get a clear channel license, they do not get them, and he was never going to get one in New England. He had 50,000 regional 50,000 watt regional stations, but he wasn't ever going to get that clear channel.
Yes.
He saw FM radio as kind of a way of leveling the playing field, because with FM radio, it simply doesn't have the propagation characteristics of AM radio. There's no interstation interference. The geographic range of an FM radio station is limited. FM radio stations start acting kind of the same, whereas in AM radio, there's a big difference between, say, a 500-watt station and a 50,000-watt channel station. So Shepherd invested an enormous amount of money building FM stations in the Boston area. He was one of many, but he was just so important, and he was so well connected to the broadcast industry. He was able to bring in other broadcast entrepreneurs from other cities and states too.
Now, how long did this run? Were they able to get advertising? Were there a certain degree of commercial success, or was it something that eventually fades?
FM radio itself kind of. The story gets kind of confusing because there were fewer FM radio station licenses in 1952 than, say, 1948. The number of stations in America actually went into decline. And Shepherd, again, he's not the only one who's doing this, but a lot of big AM radio broadcasters invested in FM radio. And it, particularly after World War II, it was a real commercial service, and there was a great deal of excitement about it. And yes, they were attracting advertisers. They were real networks. The problem is it kind of puttered along, and I don't think it's coincidental that as the number of broadcast stations was going into decline, it went at its lowest peak right around February 1954, when Armstrong committed suicide.
This is interesting.
It started picking up a little bit after that, but as I say, it was very, very slow. America was just really slow about adopting FM radio. Like I say, it wasn't until the 1980s that there were more FM radio stations than AM radio stations, whereas in Europe, FM radio dominated the entire continent, and the Soviet Union as well.
It's an interesting divergence. I had a fellow on who used to be a factory service representative for Grundig for many, many years and has a fancy for European sets. And he seemed to think that, you know, due to the fact that some of the topography posed challenges to bigger AM rigs in Europe, that FM, the fact that it was a little bit more local, wasn't as much of an issue, and that it was really latched onto very strongly in post-World War II Europe, and just, you know, it didn't have that feel over here in the U.S. But, you know, Armstrong helps get this up off the road, off the ground, and he certainly has the friends and the connections to help promote this. And, you know, I think we're just coming up almost on the anniversary, or it was in January, of Armstrong's death. What happens later in Armstrong's life? And certainly it's hard to read into, you know, look into somebody's mind and read their thoughts, but, you know, he seems to still be having some impact and a certain degree of relevance in radio. And yet you read these stories that towards the end of his life, you know, he was a man who, you know, granted he had some legal issues, he was still pursuing, trying to vindicate, you know, some of his patents guess eventually his wife would win. But what was his mindset? What was going on with his head as far as himself and radio and his life, even, you know, shortly before, you know, he makes this, you know, which was big news at the time, you know, this decision to end his own life?
It's pretty much of a sad story, particularly after World War II. One thing Armstrong did was he hired a top flight publicity agent, and he was spending something like $17,000 a year on publicity for FM radio. Armstrong understood the importance of publicity and selling FM radio, and he had some success with that. At the same time, he developed what I believe was a paranoia that concerned a lot of his friends. I mean, a lot of people think that Armstrong and RCA were just feuding with each other. But the truth is more complicated than that. His best friends worked at RCA. He had, being the largest shareholder there, he had free run of the labs, and his social life was largely RCA engineers. So it was understandably painful for him. He's the one who developed the conspiracy theory that Sarnoff, in particular, had singled out FM radio trying to kill it. He never grasped the fact that Sarnoff didn't think about FM radio and the managers didn't understand how it worked. He thought they were trying to kill it. He launched a lawsuit against RCA in 1949, and it turned out to be brutal. He testified on the stand, I believe it was about a year and a half solid. I interviewed Armstrong's patent attorney when I was researching my book, and I told him I had gone through all this microfilm, all these documents that Armstrong had secured during the discovery process of the trial, and his attorney said only three people had gone through that microfilm. He says, I have, you have, Gary, and the major has.
Uh-huh.
And he said he remembered about two or three weeks before Armstrong committed suicide, he had spent about a week or two going through the microfilm, and he came out and said, they didn't know as much as I thought they did. In other words, his own conspiracy theory, he realized, was ill-founded. If he read the same things I did, he's reading RCA managers saying, first of all, we're not afraid of our FM radio because it doesn't do anything useful, and second, we're going to need RCA anyway to keep it going. Absolutely no fear about FM radio.
Sure.
In any case, Armstrong got very discouraged and depressed about the lawsuit, and he opened up 18 other lawsuits against other companies for violation of patents, and that seemed to unhinge him. He just got very depressed. There's a terribly sad story about how he hit his wife with a fireplace.
Yes.
She left him, and he went into a decline after that, and stepped out. From what I understand, he stepped out of. He removed the air conditioner in the 13th floor apartment and stepped out.
Yeah, you know, and again, I mean, in light of the fact that, you know, here's a guy, obviously a bright guy, and after testifying and then going through all of this and maybe coming to grips with the fact that, well, gee, maybe I wasn't right after all in this, and given the fact that he was so close with many of these individuals who are at RCA, and, you know, how could I be so wrong about my friends that, you know, that does lead to some type of an emotional breakdown. And, you know, he leaves this very, you know, thoughtful, sort of loving, you know, message to his wife, and just like that, it's all over for him.
Yes, it's a terrible tragedy, and I admit I take Armstrong down a few notches in my book, but, you know, he was a human being, and that, you know, the humanity of the man comes out when you read even his technical papers. He could be quite emotional, and was an inspiration to even some of his enemies, and his friends as well, of course. So, Armstrong. It's got, you know, the end of his life is the suicide. Now, 2 years later, his biography came out, written by Lawrence Lessing, one of his friends, and his wife continued the lawsuit.
Yes.
Settled with RCA for $1 million settlement, which is probably pretty generous to RCA, but won the other lawsuits, and the last one to settle was Motorola. And Motorola, well, they didn't settle. All the other companies lost against the Armstrong estate, and the last one was in 1968 with Motorola.
And, you know, so, you know, victory at last, so to speak, but again, a very complex man, an extremely brilliant man, and again, you look in detail at a lot of these stories of, you know, the industrial history and the people who were involved with it. You know, they are human beings, and you know, the black and white starts to fade, and you start to say, well, you know, shades of gray. And certainly Armstrong, many highs, and certainly a real low note towards the end of his life, but a fascinating figure and an amazingly impactful figure. And somebody that we really enjoyed having your perspective on, Gary. I thank you so very much for being on again and to complete the circle here, so to speak, with Edwin Armstrong. Thanks so much for being on. We appreciate your time.
Okay, yeah, it was my great pleasure, Paul.
Have a great night. Thanks. Bye-bye. the Sammy Kay Orchestra with Daddy. We'd just like to thank Gary Frost again for being on the show tonight. Edwin Armstrong, pioneer of the airwaves and a fascinating figure, even after all these so many years. Check out Gary's book if you get a chance, Early FM Radio, Incremental Technology in 20th Century America. Sounds like an interesting read, and I'm sure it's available out there. Just what a history behind Armstrong. Series of great radio inventions that make it all possible for us to sit back and enjoy. You know, here's another great American innovator in music. Listen to a little bit of this. This is Mr. Les Paul here. I'm quoting from his liner notes. Mary and I were just sitting around in our Jackson Heights basement, puttering around with the Les Paul Verizer, wondering what to do with our radio show. Sounds like somebody I know. In the Mood was popular at the time. I think it was Mary's suggestion. I recorded this using the log. Perhaps the most important of my early guitars is one I affectionately call the log, built on weekends at the Epiphone factory in New York by attaching an Epiphone neck, fingerboard, and body parts to a 4x4-inch board, then sandwiching a couple of guitar body halves, or wings, as I used to call it, just for looks.
Hello there. Well, I still have my guitar hanging around my neck and my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And my invention, the Les Pulverizer, I have that on the floor.
Oh, no, you're not going to start fooling around with that thing again, are you?
Well, don't say it that way. That's our stock and trade, the Les Pulverizer.
Yes, but we've got to eat, you know. You better get a job.
Oh, well, just how do you propose that I should go out and get a job?
Well, look in the paper. Do something. How does anyone get a job?
Right now?
Well, certainly.
Well, all right, you go get the paper, and I was going to play a tune here called In the Mood. Now, I want to try something here by beating on the strings. It sound like a drum, see, and get my foot going like this.
Say, you're really busy.
You get the beat going, and then we plug one guitar into the Les Pulverizer. Well, listen.
That's Les Paul, and wouldn't it have been a shame if he did go out and get a real job? What a great loss for all of us. This is Holiday for Strings. Always sounds like something that should be in the background of a commercial, don't you agree? Call now. We're waiting to take your call. It's so soothing. So thanks for listening tonight, gang. Email the show, tubetalk1@gmail.com. We love you. Tune in again next week. Bing. I just love this thing.
Corner!